we're going to get started. Very good. Okay, good. All right. Ah, yes, thank you. All right. Okay, so we're going to get started. Good morning, everyone. You made it on this quite lovely Saturday, May 17th, 2025. My name is Eric Longo. I'm the Interim Executive Director of the Flowchart Foundation. Inspired by the legacy of John Ashbery, our mission is to explore the dynamic interplay between poetry and other art forms to foster creativity and interdisciplinary collaborations and engagement with John's work and his enduring influence on contemporary poetry and culture. So I'd like to welcome you today to our 2025 gathering to celebrate the life and work of Kenneth Koch as part of a series of events around the world to honor his centenary and his legacy. Kenneth Koch, along with John Ashbery, Frank O'Hara, and others, were part of the New School of Poetry in the early 1950s, who broke away from academic conventions, as you know, to a more experimental, playful, and informal engagement with language and subject matter. Another hallmark of the New York School was the cross-pollination between writing and the visual arts, and we'll see today many examples of such collaborations between artists and abstract expressionist painters and poets. In addition to being a world-renowned poet, Koch was also a teacher, playwright, fiction writer, and collaborator. Kenneth and John Ashbery met as undergraduates in the 1940s I can't remember where, but and they remained friends. Thank you, Harvard. And they remained friends throughout their lives. So this day is really dedicated to remembering and celebrating Kenneth Koch's life and work. So a few words of thanks. It takes a lot of time to plan and coordinate events like this, and to make it a reality. So we'd like to thank the Kenneth Koch Literary Estate and Justin Jamail, who is one of our board members, for conceiving of and curating this event. Mandana Shafa, who is our board president, and the rest of the board. Many thanks, of course, to Ryan Cook, our delightful program associate. And Josh Goodrich, who is our archivist, who's not here today, but he's the one who curated that lovely two little vitrines over there. And of course, we're honored to have Karen Koch among us today. Thank you for being here. All right, you should all have oh my goodness, I praised that. Okay, so this is kind of like we're a little behind. Unfortunately, Andrew Empstead got stuck in travel inferno yesterday, so he won't be joining us, but Jordan Davis is with us. So the first presentation is what it was like to work to have Koch as a boss, and then we'll take a lunch break, art collaborations with Anthony Atlas. Has Dottie arrived? No, not yet. Okay. Hopefully she will. and then in the afternoon, after the break, we'll have Emily and Susanna talk to us about Kenneth Koch and his biography, and we'll end the day with remembering Kenneth Koch with David Lehman and Mitch Siskin, who will join us on Zoom because I think both of them are in California. We'll take a break, and then we'll have the 5 to 6:30 here, 1,000 avant-garde plays. All 1,000 of them. And then we'll walk to the Episcopal Church to finish the day. So, quickly, a few housekeeping items. This event is being live streamed on WGXC Wave Farm Local Radio and also videotaped. So, please silence your devices. And we hope that you're going to be with us the whole day. But if you need to come in and out, make sure that you do so with minimal disruptions. We break for lunch at 1 hour on your. Programs at the back, there's a list of places where you could have lunch and or drinks. Kindly be back here by 1 p.m. so we can start in the afternoon. And Ryan for those of you who are speakers, you don't need to talk in these mics, as you can see, and I'll lend you this little thing so you can advance your slides. Any other questions, see Ryan or myself. And we have a selection of books from 53rd State Press over there for purchase. So see Rye later if you want to purchase any. And this is our only bathroom for those of you who are here. And now, with it, without any further ado, let's get started. And I'd like to welcome Jordan Davis for the first presentation of the day. So you can just advance the slide.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you. Andrew and I were going to talk about our shared experience of working as Kenneth's assistant in the 90s. It's not actually a subject Andrew and I have talked about a lot, so I was looking forward to hearing what he had to say and to asking him questions, having him ask me questions. I started working for Kenneth in 1990. I had been dating his graduate assistant who was about to take her comprehensive exams and needed to extract herself from the working relationship. She was paid by the department at Columbia, and Kenneth said, "I don't know." I was 20 at the time. He said he's very excitable. Marisa said he knows your work better than anybody I've ever met. His judgment in poetry matters is sound, and I think you should probably give him a shot. And she got out of the job. She gave me another job of hers too, working at a bookstore on 106th Street called Pomander, which didn't work out as well as the job with Kenneth. I began work. I was paid, I think, about $10 an hour by the English department. After a few years, Kenneth gave me a raise, but not before firing me several times. I assume everybody is aware of the show Arrested Development. The character, the son, the oldest son, Job, is tasked by the father to mail the insurance check that keeps the family afloat. And Job goes to the ocean and tries to throw the check into the ocean. And fails to do so. And I was more or less like that with Kenneth's mail. Kenneth would give me things to mail, and I said, "This isn't what I want to do." But I would eventually remember to mail the things. The main thing that he wanted me to do, and I don't, do we have any? No, that's the video. That's wonderful. The main thing that he wanted me to do was, he was a big adherent of Mayakovsky's How to Make Verses. He taught this book in his classes. He talked about the methods in it. Mayakovsky says a number of wonderful things in the book, which is, one is you need to write a lot. You need to not tell people what you're writing, because if they hear it and they run away with it, they may publish something with that phrase before you get to, and that would be disappointing. Mayakovsky relates the story of coming up with the phrase a cloud in trousers and realizing that this is perhaps the greatest thing anyone has ever said, and accidentally saying it to another poet in conversation and realizing his mistake, and then realizing the only way to cover over it was to speak very rapidly about many other things so as to cloud the mind of his listener so that they would forget. And it turned out, it did work, and they forgot, and Mayakovsky got there first. But one of the most important things in How to Make Verses is what he says is that the most important thing a poet needs every day is a clean copy of what they wrote the day before. And Kenneth had an Olivetti, and he had pencils, and he had scissors, and he had tape, and he had grease pencils, and he had ballpoint pens, and he had color pens, and he would mark up, he would cut things up, and he would make this beautiful collaged mess every day of what he had been writing. But that is not a clean copy. And so he would hand these things to me, and I was a sophomore in college, and I would take them and I would go type them, and I would bring them. This was back in the days, it was before cheap laser printers. I was still using a dot matrix printer, and so I would bring him these things, and he would be so happy because for $10 an hour he would have the main requirement of a poet, which is a clean copy in the morning, and he would get to work. And we worked for several years. It was about a year into the process where he gave me a work that I felt intense despair. It was a 50 page-long parody of the book reviews in the TLS. And it seemed to be so suffused with irritation about the direction of literature and not getting enough attention. It just there was so much that was just not happy about it. And there were parts that were funny, but it was spring break, and my parents saw that I was moping around the house completely disconsolate, and they said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "Well, I have this task that I don't want to do." And they said, "Well, have you tried just telling him that the poem's not very good?" And I said, I froze in horror. I said, "You don't know what you're saying." They said, "Really, if you can't do the task, you should probably just say, here's why, otherwise you'll end up not being employed by him." I said, "Well, that seems to be an outcome that's coming toward me rapidly in any case." So I went to work, and I said, he said, "Where's the poem?" And I know this is going on the radio. There is an off-color word that I have to say in just a second, so please forgive me, people in radio land. I said, "Well, I didn't type it." And he said, "Why not?" And I said, "Well, it's not up to your standards." And he said, "Fuck off, you're fired." And I said, "Okay." And I handed him back his TypeScript. And there's a very long hallway in the apartment. there we go. This is a nice picture to have in the background as I tell you this part. There's a very long hallway in the apartment with a big set design from a play of Kenneth's. That's set in Guadalajara. It's a big painting by Red Grooms of a fountain in a square, and Gaucho walking by with an amazing hat. And I was about three quarters of the way past this set design when Kenneth shouted down the hallway. He said, "White Fang, come back here." He called me White Fang sometimes. And I walked back, and he said, "You're right, it's no good." He said, "Look, we're going to have a new arrangement. The arrangement is this. Instead of my just handing you things to type, I'm going to read them to you. You can tell me, if you're up to this, if you agree to this, you can tell me whether they are worth your time typing." And I said, okay, sure. You're going to pay me to sit and listen. And he said, "Yes, I'm going to pay you to sit and listen, and then I'm going to pay you to type." And so that was the arrangement that we had from about 1991 to 2000, when I had life transitions, took a different job that was somewhat more demanding of my time, and a baby was born, and there was a lot that changed for me. But from 1991 to 2000, that was the role, was I was the sort of the first reader and listener to Kenneth's poems. And after about 4 years of this arrangement, Kenneth was asked by the American Poetry Review. There we go. American Poetry Review to, that's an excerpt from his poem, My Olivetti Speaks, which is in his book, Straits. It's a poem in prose, mostly about poetry. He said, people don't really like poems about poetry, but nevertheless, I have to write them sometimes. And so he was asked by American Poetry Review to have somebody interview him. And he said, "Do you want to do this?" And I said, "Sure." And so what we arranged was that I would ask him questions, and then I would sit and type. I was a fast typist. And I would type down and read back to him every few sentences, and he would tell me whether I'd gotten them right, if he wanted to qualify or change things, and then he would say some more things, and we'd go on this way. And this process took several months and was mostly in his house in Bridgehampton, some at the apartment on Claremont in New York, and some in the car driving back and forth between the two places. So this is an introduction. We published, the interview was published in the American Poetry Review, and I think this is unique in the interviews that they've published. My questions were almost completely erased from the interview. So it was, he said sometimes, one of his compositional ideas was inspired by French cuisine. He said sometimes you cook the soup and you leave the onions in, and sometimes you take the onions out, and I was the onions. But we used about 12% of the full text in the American Poetry Review. After Kenneth died, I had started with a colleague of mine from Teachers and Writers, which was another job that Kenneth helped me get. Christopher Egger and I edited an iOS Apple App Store magazine store app, And we published two tranches of the interview there. And we would have published more, but it turns out to cost quite a bit of money to publish an app. We had a very generous arrangement with a designer, and he said, well, we're actually going out of business because we can't make any money with this generous arrangement. And the guy that they directed us to said, okay, that'll be $10,000 a year, which, sure, that's not a lot of money, but margins are slim. So this is an introduction to the entire text, which we were going to publish, and which we got about 30% of the way through. In 1995, I interviewed Kenneth Koch at length over several occasions. I was 5 years in as Kenneth's assistant and first reader. American Poetry expressed interest in publishing an interview, so Kenneth and I discussed in advance several literary historical subjects he wanted to get his thoughts about on the record. I mentioned a few things I was curious about, too, such as his feelings about comic poetry and his comics. Mm-hmm. Kenneth made a book of comics, which I recommend. What he had considered doing for a living besides teaching, his drive for clarity, and his competing drive to follow the sounds of words and their associations wherever they might lead, and then, too, about his competitive streak. We spoke in New York City, in Bridgehampton, and in Kenneth's car going between the two. He talked, I typed, reading sentences back every few minutes. He remarked that even though I was a fast typist, it was useful to have to pause between thoughts to hear what he had said. Mm-hmm. Kenneth was voluble and typically masterful. The full transcript ran to several dozen pages. A short excerpt of the interview, much revised by Kenneth, appeared in APR in 1996 and was included in The Art of Poetry, a collection of his essays published by University of Michigan Press. We talked about using the full transcript at some later date, but the opportunity never arose. I came across the full transcript in 2013. The interview instantly reminded me of what being around Kenneth was actually like in a way very little else has done. There are gaps in the text and perhaps more transcription than there would have been if Kenneth had had the chance to cut it. However, he was able to comment on each sentence at the time of transcription. And so I'm going to read a little bit of this, and if it gets tedious, stop me. let's see. This is a little bit about Stendhal, and it goes on from there. I was just reading Stendhal in a book of excerpts on certain topics. He's even good that way. One thing I like in a writer is when he's able to give pleasure in every moment. Like this end of April day, we're sitting in with this breeze blowing and different colored flowers. But the reason it's easier to come by a day like this than a writer like Stendhal, the breeze that's blowing on my face would be giving me an intelligence and understanding of what I've been doing all my life, giving me hope for my life. There's something about that truthfulness that's not the same as information that makes one content in a certain way with not completely content with the fact that one is going to die, but at least content that one has lived. And the extraordinary surprise of clarity. I think of Frank O'Hara in the poem Khrushchev is coming on the right day. The autumn wind is bringing clarity. And I think maybe Frank had art and literature in mind. Frank would say, if I said it, I meant it. Anyway, now some writers. A sign in a writer to explain my prejudices a bit. I like writers who write totally engaging dramatic stories, but I'm especially grateful to writers who make every sentence a pleasure. Among these are Stendhal, Sasha, Kawabata, Shklovsky. Proust, of course, is an immortal sentence maker. What a man. There are also beautiful sentences in Out of Africa by Isaac Dinesen and the novels of James Salter. These are just some writers. There are very beautiful sentences in Scott Fitzgerald. There are many people who think that a taste for sentences, Henry James is a great sentence writer too, may be frivolous. But a similar taste for texture is not accounted a frivolous taste in painting or music. One may like Ravel for the texture of the work. Of course, if one just liked the sentences and there was nothing to hold them up, probably wouldn't like them so much. But I don't think it's a frivolous taste. It's a prejudice. I trust someone who writes sentences that catch my heart. I don't trust writers who don't, I think. Very few poets are any good, judged by these standards of mine. Ezra Pound says that poetry is simply the best conversation of one's time. So I think, in a way, one might say, starved for conversation, just as one may be starved for the voice of a lost lover or a friend who has died. Anyway, one doesn't want this voice that one is starved for to be pretentious, bitter, willfully depressed, arrogant, proud of itself, trivial, sort of happily flustered by the temporary enthusiasms of its own time. It's hard to write anything good. Where does it come from? I think one has to read a lot, and one needs people to talk to who are quick, enthusiastic, inspired, ruthless. One also needs to get out in the world, I'm just speaking for myself, to be jolted not only by what's beautiful, but by what one hadn't been thinking about. A certain color car coming from a certain kind of street or music coming out of an apartment, but what resists one. Totally different attitudes, different lives. I think it's good for me anyway. One can't be jolted too much, or one doesn't have enough peace to write. Maybe it's all sort of Don Quixote-like. If one's a poet, maybe one goes out and conquers what is it he thinks is a lion, a trash can? Some little things happen on the street or in an art gallery on the subway. Because your mind is working in a rather odd way, you're writing instead of amassing capital or curing people. Nietzsche says the poet is immoral because he makes poetry out of whatever happens to be there. But whether it's good or bad, painful or pleasant or whatever, well, this is a bit too abstract. Return to base. Beep. And so I ask him, are you permitted to teach in the schools if you're amoral? Can you just say anything if you're amoral? Nietzsche just meant, I don't know what he was thinking of. What of William Carlos Williams when he says the anarchy of poverty delights me? It would be a different attitude to walk through a poor part of Paterson or Rutherford and have the only thought in your mind be to institute social reform. To see the beauty of some things poverty causes is not immoral. To sentimentalize about it is. To enjoy the beauty of a man in an old torn sweater sweeping leaves in front of a small, perhaps uncomfortable house, and to like that more, to make an aesthetic judgment that that pleases you more than the sight of a rich man expensively dressed stepping into a limousine, is not immoral. The artistic attitude is not the same as the practical attitude. Works of art lead to practical results. It's a problem you can think about. Hemingway says in his book on bullfighting, I'm jumping ahead. Oh no, there's actually a really nice thing here. You can certainly go too far. Count Chana, was that the name of Mussolini's son-in-law? When he was bombing the Ethiopians, he talked about the beauty of the bombs going off. I think that was going too far. Apollinaire talked about the beauty of anti-aircraft fire. I saw that in World War II, and it was still beautiful. Pink flakes. I don't know what it looks like now. Probably invisible. I do think that the best poetry probably sees more in it than just how pretty it is. I think Apollinaire is part of the best poetry. I forget what he says. The other extreme is Blake, who says he hears a soldier sighing and imagines blood running down the walls. It can be a great pleasure to read Apollinaire after Blake. You can have both. Hemingway says in his book on bullfighting, there's no going back in pleasure. And after Whitman gives you this easy, easy way to talk about things and stay as long as you want, it's hard to go back to the rigorous methods and structures of poets who may be greater than Whitman. The difficulty doesn't last too long, but the pleasure of poetry consists in these constant pleasures. If you go back to Herbert and Dunn, you get trouble. Once you're used to lying down in the grass, even with Keats, it's not so easy. Thus, to have Whitman's grandiloquent ease, the luxury of his timing that you can go very fast, you can go slow, you can have real time, just the ease of that poem existing in time and being about what you're feeling rather than any construction you've made, you put your feelings you felt, it's hard to give up that ease. And I guess one may temporarily feel after reading Whitman, that's it, what else can one do? And you go back and you read Dunn, Shakespeare, Keats, and you want to keep Whitman's selectable qualities, almost irresistible qualities of being able to say, I stopped somewhere waiting for you. How can you give that up once you've read it? But that's not the real me. It's hard to give that stuff up. You want to keep it, but you want to get the sensuousness of Keats, the electric passion of Gerard Manley Hopkins, the brilliant intellect and wit of Dunn, humor and the worldliness of Byron, the vast consciousness including everything which are in Shakespeare and Tolstoy, but not in Whitman. And thus we have poésie moderne. Now, whether people have done this gets them into my class in modern poetry at Columbia. And then the way it turns out, trying to carry all these heavenly parcels all at once, poets seem to sprain their legs or hips, so they walk off in funny directions. And so one gets poetry that's absolutely as good as much of the poetry of the past, but is eccentric, like Rilke's, for example, Duino Elegies, or the collected works of Wallace Stevens, for example, which are beautiful and about everything, but also largely and very often about the window that you're seeing it through, that is your mind, imagination. Pasternak, for example, is, as far as I can tell in translation, a great poet. The world he covers in his poetry is limited. It's wonderful, so intense, but it's limited. It's not as strange as Rilke. Sexual passion, perpetually in search of a thunderstorm. And then there's Ezra Pound. The cantos are absolutely wonderful. I think they're the best that he wrote. It would be a strange judgment of them to say that they're not eccentric. This is theoretical, but it needed to be done. That total fragmentation needed to be done so we could see what's really there, what's worth saving to put back together to make great poetry. People have said about Pound that he was a great poet, but he never wrote a great poem. I think that's silly. I think the cantos is a great poem. One remarkable gesture after another, like some remarkable dance company that comes out on stage, then marches off, that reminds you of medieval France and 20th century England all at once. They're kind of wonderful, those short poems. Curious about Pound is that all the people who are devoted to him have this religious attitude. They're fanatics. I noticed that even as I was being slightly critical of him, I feared the hordes of Poundites coming after me. I wonder why he seems kind of sacred the way, say, William Carlos Williams doesn't. Williams has admirers like that, but they're mainly sensible folk. Pound spends more time than William Carlos Williams does growling and fighting. Let's get rid of this shit. Well, William Carlos Williams doesn't. Just ignores the shit and gets on with the work. I think Pound attracts certain grr fanciers, people who like to be mad, like the Michigan militia. There are things in Pound and the cantos that are more beautiful and more satisfying than anything else in modern poetry, I think. He satisfies a need for... The fragmentation is wonderful, the breaking up of everything. It's something I get from the greatest paintings of de Kooning. What I wanted to finish saying was that if Whitman seemed to inspire a lot of poets and also make them think they couldn't do what had been done before, and the result... Yeah, there we go. And the result is that 20th century poets in America, anyway, wanted to have the good qualities of Whitman along with wit, sensuous and everything. For the generation after these poets who wrote these strange, wonderful works like Stevens, William Pound, well, I don't know. I was talking about my taste. Poets I really like of my own generation who've come through that poetry of Rilke and Pound and Stevens and so on have made a poetry that is still full of life, energy, and excitement, and it seems either to really be about or to represent something that's important either in physical or social or artistic experience. Ashbery seems eccentric the way Rilke does, maybe even more so, but his work has almost always affected me as pretty close to one center of what I'm concerned about. And since he's such a good writer, it's what I'm concerned about, but didn't know I was concerned about until he wrote his poems. But it comes through this whole modern barbed wire with really, for all the decadent-seeming things about his work, with a lot of energy, happiness, and ambition. It's strong stuff. He doesn't give up. He keeps turning out ambitious things. It seems like John's always trying to solve some problem that can't be solved. One side of his brain seems to think he can solve the great problem of what everything means, and the other side knows he can't. And it's like a ping-pong game between these two sides, and that's where the energy comes from. He never tires of this friendly game with himself. He loves, or his poems love, this combat the way one likes to play tennis. In any case, the poets who've come through merely wanted to, without the kind of genius or energy that O'Hara and Ashbery have, want to write poems that are merely in the center of experience, and that are formally more conventional or central, using the discoveries of Pound, William Carlos Williams, Stevens, taking all this raw material, actually finished poetry, and making conventional poems. Maybe I'm just theorizing. I think the mistake is you can't do that. You really have to create something wild and original of your own in order to use that stuff. A lot of modern academic poetry is full of echoes of Rilke and Lorca and Rimbaud and Baudelaire and other very great poets, but it seems to be put in by some sort of aesthetic interior decorator. Frank O'Hara is starting all over from this very wild impulse, writing very original poems. I don't mean in quality, caught up with Mayakovsky. It's like he could use Mayakovsky. A mild academic poet writing like Rilke can't use Rilke. I think probably the only road to really being able to use our great strange predecessors in France and Russia and America and other places, the only chance is to have something like their kind of energy, wildness, to take the risks they took. I don't think you can sit back and use the techniques of Attila the Hun or Alexander the Great. I don't think it's like science where you can take the discoveries of a real original like Einstein and make the machine work. Poems aren't machines. I asked him, how much do you like being regarded as a humorous poet? What do you think about humor and poetry and about wit? He said, being witty is probably like being kind or mean-spirited or inclined to anger. I don't think you can do much about it. I don't think it's something you make a decision about. If one is witty, one can only be glad one is witty. One can certainly hope one is not a buffoon, a clown, somebody who dilutes everything by laughing at it. One is not superficial and merely silly. It's difficult. The difficulty is not in being witty. If I'm witty, the difficulty is with people's response to it. That is, a funeral service is one thing. It may be profound in some way to get up and tap dance and laugh a lot at a funeral service. However, nobody ever wants you to do it. Briefly, being comic enables me to be lyrical, or it did in the past. I detest the smart aleckiness of a lot of the poetry supposedly having to do with the New York School. That's the comic misused. Sorry, guys. There was something else I wanted to read you, but maybe I should take this moment while I'm not vamping to ask if there are any questions.
I have a question.
Yes.
So what was it like, because you were a student and you were working for him, and you were just working for him. So how did, well, did you, in what way did you like stay a student at, during these periods? What was
I in 1995, one of Kenneth's great students and another poet I was lucky to know, David Shapiro, suggested to me, wouldn't I like to go get an MFA at Brown? And I said, I like New York. And he said, well, but they would pay you, he said, you don't have to pay for this. You can go be a full-time student of poetry for 2 years. And I told Kenneth about this, and he said, why do you want to study with a poet who's not me? And I thought about it for a while. And I said, well, I live in a tiny apartment, and I work at a job, and I come see you once a week, and I do these things. He said, isn't that enough? And I said, would you write me a letter of recommendation anyway? And he sighed, and he wrote it. And I got in, and I went and I visited, and it was very nice. Providence is a lovely place, and it was a very generous offer. And I met one of the students who I've since known, and I'm part of a collective that's published a number of her books. But I asked her, I said, what do you do when you're not in class? Because they had two classes a semester, and the classes met twice a week. And she said, well, we watch a lot of TV. And I thought, and I asked C.B. Wright, who was running the program at the time, I said, can I have a little more time to think about it? She said, no, the offer's too good. Decide now. I said, okay. And so I ended up continuing working with Kenneth instead of going and becoming part of the MFA industrial complex at a great cost to my so-called career, but not at a great cost to my poetic education. I was constantly handing him books to say, why don't you ever talk about this? Why don't you read this? And he said, I don't care about this. Or he said, oh, that's interesting. What do you see in it? And I would show him and say, well, that is interesting. I hadn't thought about that. I mean, there was a mentor relationship, but he was also the way in the classroom with elementary school students, he took the human individuality of the student seriously, and he wanted to learn from what he was, the people he was teaching. He treated me with the same respect and dignity, and it was great. How was your experience? Justin Jamail also worked as Kenneth's assistant.
It was similar, although my working relationship was much more shallow. I was making clean copies, but yeah, it was very important to have that. The most valuable part of it was having him as a teacher during this time, more than the boss.
When did you work with him?
So 2000, 2002.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I have a question.
Yes.
Oh. Okay.
No, you go.
Just, will this be published anywhere, the interview?
Like I say, part of it has been, and it is in the art of the excerpt is in the Art of Poetry.
I know, yeah, but the rest of it.
I once asked Kenneth after finishing the Red Robins, and he was sitting at the time next to 16 cartons of the Red Robins. I said, "Why didn't you publish more novels?" He gave me that, like, I'm not going to let loose on you, stare like this, the very narrow, he said, leaning forward slightly, like to see if I'm being real or not. And he said, well, he said, it was very difficult to get people interested in the first one. He said, it was a lot of fun to write. And if the opportunity arises, I could see doing it. He said, right now I'm enjoying this was when he was writing the stories that were Hotel Lambosa. If there were a publisher that was interested in my figuring out, another thing you should know about this is that computer formats change. And the program that I typed up all of these remarks in has been off the market for like 25 years.
Yeah.
And the recovery of the file that I managed to pull off, not only the formats of the files change, but the formats of the media that you're keeping these things on. I think it was on a zip disk.
Oh,
I don't think you can even, at this point, I think it's a lot of work to get from a zip disk onto a machine's disk. So I was able to extract the file, and I was able to convert it to a somewhat reasonable form. And then I printed out the file, and then at some point the electronics became corrupted.
Wow.
And so I had a file of unnumbered pages that fell on the floor at one point. And if you know Kenneth's really very crazy poem, When the Sun Tries to Go On, from 1951-52, a similar thing happened with the text of that poem. He dropped he got to 100 pages. The goal, Frank O'Hara said, this is really good, you should write 100 of these. So he wrote 100 of them, and he was very excited about it, and it fell on the floor, and it scattered everywhere. And his wife at the time, the way Kenneth related it, laughed at him for about 2 days because he could not put them back into anything like the original order. And so that's what happened with this interview. So I've tried to, there were already lacunae because of the way the file was recovered. So I'm not entirely sure that I have the entire text. It's a very kind question. It has a very generous view of publishing. And if you know of a publisher who might be interested in a completely chaotic, filled with lacunae, needing much copy editing transcript, I'd be glad to talk.
What's the ratio of published? You said it was maybe
20%? Probably about 20% of the text has appeared in one form or another. 5% in American Poetry Review.
Have you read us a lot of unpublished
I think none of that was, maybe half of what I read was published in Ladowich.
So, did I hear this correctly? You said he had a name for you?
He had many names for me.
White Fang was it?
Yeah, there's a brief Jack London phase. I'm not sure why he thought that, but he just sort of would grab my wife at the time said Kenneth would put a post-it note on you if it were possible to do. Like he would just go around putting things on things as a way of relating to the world. But this was she also said if it were funny and it were at a party, he would put a slice of brie on your head if it would keep the room moving. And there was something to that. There was just like how are we going to make this, how are we going to keep everything going? I don't think they got along, Kenneth and Anna. I like the idea of the slice of brie on the head. I think she meant it not to be nice, but I thought it was... Bongo.
Well, after he got back from Africa.
Yeah. The Bongo family in Gabon is still in the news. Apparently, Omar Bongo. He was very. He had taken a USIA trip of Africa at one point, and so there was a lot of detailed firsthand knowledge of African politics and people. But he was very. He loved that there was a world leader named Omar Bongo. Although he knew enough about Gabon to know, like, wasn't so great for Gabon to have a leader named Omar Bongo. But there was a lot of. When I say name, I mean he used a term and he applied it to me. I don't think it was something where he had filed in his memory bank, in his intimate emotional Rolodex, that I was White Fang. Would you like to hear more of this text, or is that enough reading? I'll read a little more of this text, and then we'll move. How close are we to the time when I'm supposed to stop?
About 5 minutes.
What's the best part of this? Let's see. Well, why don't I read more about John Ashbery?
Yeah.
I hope it's all nice. I think it mostly is. What quality of John Ashbery's work do you wish your work had? As with the work of any poet I admire enormously, I don't think I really wish that my poetry were like his. I'm glad it's there to stir me up, to be as exciting as it is. I feel the same way about Frank O'Hara's poetry and Pasternak's poetry and a lot of poetry, that I'm... What else we get? Yeah. The attempt to really get the qualities of somebody else's poetry seems to be, for me, sort of a Sisyphean enterprise. Unless you're really willing to be somebody else, give up being yourself, you can't get the qualities of someone else's work. I admire the way he's able to end poems, the way his poems seem almost effortlessly to have a satisfying form. I like the music of his work a lot, the way the music, although metrically identifiable, is identifiably satisfying. I like the way he can bring in so many tones and so many different kinds of language together. I like the way he can keep a balance between being very funny, even silly, and very serious at the same time. I like the way he can seemingly, and I put this in quotes, talk about nothing in a beautiful and interesting way. He's like a wonderful explorer of some Partica of Poetry, who comes back looking wonderful but with no photographs. His poems give one the impression of having been there without one's knowing quite what it was like. I like that. I myself, I think John and I, Franco Herd too, have in common a lingering similarity of the New York School, an enthusiasm for happiness, variety, and excitement, not wanting to miss any part of the dance, any part of the party. Even when John's poetry is melancholy, sad, I can always feel white skirts whirling by and hear the music in the background.
Oh, yeah.
That I like very much. It's not envy, but something I'd like to have. I think John can stay further away from ordinary meanings with more grace and interestingness than anyone I know.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I talk about any poet, I'm talking about his best poems. I don't suppose anybody can do it all the time. John doesn't seem to be tempted by entering the dancing contest. If I talk about his poems as a wonderful dance held at Christmas time, to play in the band to sell tickets or anything, but content to be sort of an entranced observer, participating with his nerves and feelings. He doesn't seem to want to play a part in the dance. Yeah, okay. Another aspect of my not envying, you can't have a part of a personality or talent with having the whole thing, and I like my own personality well enough.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody my age wants to give theirs up. If I say I admire the way John ends his poems, so this is 1985, it must have been 70. If I admire the way John ends his poems, it isn't to say I would leave those endings alone if they were in my poems. They're not my endings, they're his. There's a story Kierkegaard tells about a peasant who goes into town, sells all his produce, buys a new pair of boots, and gets very drunk with the money. On the way home, he lies down on the side of the road with his legs in the road and goes to sleep. Someone comes by and says, "Get out of the road," and the drunk man looks at his new trousers and new legs and says, those aren't my legs, drive on." John's endings aren't my own. Why haven't you sought development of your work in Hollywood? Somebody should have made a movie of Coe years ago, but nobody did. Fame is always coming around to bless me and then going elsewhere. The whole thing about fame is that you don't need much. You don't want to get less famous or less rich. Everybody gets less beautiful, so you get used to that. Is there anything else at all that I can read? Nah.
Would you read that Arctic Explorer part again?
Sure.
Slow?
Sure. I'll try. I like the way he can seemingly, and I put this in quotes, talk about nothing in a beautiful and interesting way. He's like a wonderful explorer of some Antarctica of poetry who comes back looking wonderful but with no photographs. His poems give one the impression of having been there without one's knowing quite what it was like. I like that. I myself think John and I and Franco Herrera too have in common a lingering similarity of the New York School, an enthusiasm for happiness, variety, and excitement, not wanting to miss any part of the dance. Any part of the party. So I think it's lunchtime.
I just want to say one thing about Jordan, because the first time when Kenneth and he would be working, he'd come Tuesday nights, and first for tea, and then they'd start to work, and I'd make dinner for us at 10. And that going back and forth of his reading his stuff and so on was hard. And I remember early on, walking past the door, and I heard him, Jordan, say, "No, Kenneth, that time, you can't use that image." He said, "Why not?" And I could just hear this, and he said, "Well, you," and John said, "you use that same image," and he said some things, and said, in the poem, thus and so, and then he said, "I did." Jordan got up, walked across the room, pulled a book out, and read it, and it's really, and he said, "Yeah, I did. Well, I just didn't remember that," and I just was stunned, because I'm not a poet, so I was, you know, there was no competition, there was nothing like that. That wasn't my forte. So, but I just was extraordinary. And they said, oh, okay, let's go on. And I thought, okay, that's... and I thought, that's how this will be.
Yeah, I was wrong a lot of the time. I told him he was working on a poem, and I said, Kenneth, this is exactly like six of your poems from the 70s and 80s. Why do you want to do this again? You've done this before. He said, no, I think people are going to like this one. And he went on. It was a poem called One Train May Hide Another.
Yes.
It's one of his best loved poems. And I was saying, ah, let's move on. Let's do something more interesting. And he said, no.
Well, he would be happy to tell you you were wrong.
Oh, sure. I listened. So.
But it was amazing that you could tell him he was.
Yeah.
And I just marveled at it. And it was a weekly occurrence. That was EE. And I just kind of couldn't get over that relationship for many, many years. It was really important.
I think so.